This morning, I'd like to reflect a little bit more on checking the attitude, exploring that aspect of our experience. Every experience that happens in our body and mind. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, things that go on in our mind, physical objects, mental objects, from the perspective of what can be learned in terms of freeing our mind from struggle, from suffering, from stress, every experience can reveal to us the truth of its impermanent, unreliable, not self nature. And so from the perspective of the cultivation towards freeing the mind from the ways we get involved with experience, wanting it, not wanting it, confusion about it, it doesn't matter what is happening. The suffering, the struggle that we may experience is in our minds. And if we are experiencing a kind of suffering, it's because there's something not seen. Now, that doesn't mean there's not going to be unpleasant, very unpleasant, perhaps, experience. What this points to is the possibility that the mind can be at ease, even in the midst of the most horrific of experience, horrific of circumstances. Now, that's a tall order. And yet that is what the Buddha proposes. He says is possible. I can't claim to be there. But I do have a very strong sense of the possibility of that. And so the teachings that Sayadaw offers really point to that relationship, to beginning to get familiar with what is going on in our minds. Where is the contraction? Where is the pull? Where is the push? You know, in terms of how we are in relationship to experience. Because that is where the mind can become free of that reactivity. That reactivity is not it is possible to not have that reactivity. It may not be possible to change the circumstances, but we can know our relationship to it. And through that knowing, it's like the system begins to understand what is adding to the suffering and what can be released. So I think Gil sometimes talks about optional suffering, you know, in this way, the what's added in this relationship can be released. And so, you know, the relationship, when we have an aversive relationship to something, or, you know, in particular, aversive relationship to something unpleasant, there's a feedback loop there that makes it even more and more and more challenging and unpleasant. And so if that feedback loop can be cut, then we are left with the unpleasantness. There's a teaching in the suttas where the Buddha says, what, you know, both people, you know, people who are awakened, people who are fully free, experience unpleasant experience. People who are not free experience unpleasant experience. And what's the difference between them? He says, the person who is not free experiences an unpleasant experience, and they weep and moan and beat their breast and say, why me? Why is this happening to me? How do I get rid of this? How do I fix this? How do I change this? So they are adding that reactivity to it. And he said, someone who is free, when they experience something unpleasant, they experience something unpleasant. There's not the added reactivity. So the practice of checking into the relationship to experience begins to expose just how much and how deeply conditioned these responses and reactions are. So simply seeing them once or twice does not usually, you know, make them go poof, just like, oh, I see it, it's gone. What happens is that we learn with it, we learn from it. But the difference between being embedded in the reactivity, or having the reactivity embedded in how we're paying attention to experience, and knowing that that reactivity is present, knowing that that filter or view is present, it's huge. It's a huge difference. And so this exploration of checking the attitude helps to uncover hidden agendas, hidden habits, views, reactivity that's below the level of our conscious awareness, or helps perhaps reveal reactivity that we are involved in, as opposed to simply aware of. And it helps us to understand how our minds work, how that those agendas, those attitudes affect our experience. So we get familiar with the conditioning process of the mind. And we can see too what happens when we become aware of it, how the experience can really shift. Even if the reactivity continues, being aware of it, oh, what's happening is there's this agenda, or there is a not liking something. There's a pain in my body and resistance is happening. The difference between being resistant with that pain and knowing resistance is happening is quite large. The experience of that difference gives us a sense of what happens, or so the whole experience can change, can be more easeful, because the mind is okay with the resistance and knows the resistance, as opposed to is embedded in the resistance. That feedback loop of the resistance and the pain is like kind of cut, or at least weakened substantially. So this checking the attitude begins to show us what's going on in our mind, help us to see things that might not be so clear to us. I've said a few times that, check the attitude from time to time, and not, just like every single second. I have not found it useful to, just with every experience that's recognized, kind of do this, oh, what's the attitude about that? What's the attitude about that? It gets busy. It gets, a feeling of kind of like endless regression. Oh, there's resistance. What's the attitude about resistance? Oh, there's fear. Oh, what's the attitude about fear? And it can kind of just get too busy. And so I found that in a sitting of, I don't know, half an hour or 45 minutes, checking the attitude every few minutes, maybe just as a kind of, especially at the beginning, we need to kind of strengthen that capacity that we have to check the attitude, to be curious about it. And at first it does require a kind of a conscious checking in. What I would say is that as the practice continues, there's much less of a need for a conscious checking into the attitude because it has become just a part of the curiosity of experience. It just becomes a natural part of the practice. But initially, it does need to kind of be a conscious orienting to, from time to time, what is the relationship to experience. So in my own practice, especially in the first few years, I just would kind of occasionally check in. And then I found it for myself a few times that it's very helpful to check the attitude. So I'll offer those to you as well. And the first one of those is if there's any kind of a sense of struggle, if it feels like it's hard to meditate for any reason, that's a good time to check the attitude. If it feels like there's resistance or, I can't meditate with this, that itself is an attitude. I can't meditate with this. So we talked about sleepiness yesterday, I mentioned that if you are feeling the experience of sleepiness and you're telling yourself, you hear yourself telling yourself, I'm too sleepy to meditate. If you're believing that, you're just telling yourself that, you just feel like I should stop meditating. But if you see that thought, I'm too sleepy to meditate, you are actually already aware that you're sleepy. You are aware already of the experience of sleepiness. And so, I'd like to propose that the attitude itself is in the way. It's making you believe that you can't meditate while you're sleepy, but you're already aware of sleepiness. And so maybe that's what you can be aware of. Aware that sleepiness is happening. So the attitude, if it feels like there's a struggle, check the attitude. What is the relationship to the experience? I've said several times, four basic flavors of attitude: wanting something to happen, greed, wanting something to stop happening, aversion, confusion, a disconnection, or a belief about experience, the delusion aspect of experience. So those are the ones that tend to be in the way of a clear relationship to experience. And then there's wise attitude. So if there's a struggle with experience, there's probably one of those first three happening. If there's a struggle, if there's any kind of suffering around the experience. Now, unpleasant experience can be happening with wise attitude. It's not that experience will always be pleasant, but if there's a feeling of this is a problem, I've got to fix this or change this, check the attitude. If it feels hard to meditate, check the attitude. So that's one time to check the attitude. If it feels like there's a problem, sometimes that experience of the problem, it might be a relationship to the object itself. I think I mentioned this the other day. It might be a relationship to what is happening. If there's something really unpleasant happening, the relationship might be a resistance to that unpleasant experience, for instance. But it also can be that the relationship is related more to the fact that we are meditating. It's got to do, the relationship may have to do with an agenda around meditation. So for instance, one attitude that can come up in a kind of a shift between a more focused kind of meditation practice and this kind of meditation practice where it's a more open awareness is the sense or the experience of it being a problem that the mind is taking in many things one after another. If you're familiar with a more stable or settled experience where the mind focuses on one thing, that experience of the mind taking in one thing after another somehow feels wrong or off. And so there can be the attitude that I'm not doing it right, or this can't be how it's supposed to be. So that the struggle can be more about the agenda of the meditation or not understanding that this is what's happening, that this is the process that's going on in the body and mind. So sometimes the attitudes are more about the agendas to meditation. Sometimes they're about the experience itself. So that's one time when there's a struggle happening of any kind. The next time that I found useful to check the attitude is when I return from the wandering mind. So if the mind has been wandering off, recognizing the awareness, that's the first thing when you return, when there's a return from the wandering, that's the first thing to notice is, okay, awareness has returned. So notice that and notice what's here. Checking the attitude in that moment is useful for a couple of reasons. One is that we often have a habit of judging the wandering mind, and that's an attitude right there. That's a belief that I should have been able to do it differently. It was a problem. I need to be, trying harder, whatever it is, in that moment when mindfulness returns, it's useful to check the attitude. Again, that may have more to do with agendas around the meditation, about what we think about the meditation. So that's one thing that we often have a relationship with is a belief around the wandering mind in meditation. So that's one reason it can be useful to check the attitude when we return from wandering mind. Another reason it's useful is that when the mind has wandered, if it's wandered, well, any way that it wanders, but particularly if it wanders into some kind of a memory or a story of some kind of a narrative that there's something sticky about it, that experience, that wandering, we've talked about the way thoughts shape experience. While the mind is wandering in those thoughts, while the mind is sticking in those thoughts, creating that world, there's often a quality of mind that's constructed while the mind is wandering. And if we aren't in that moment of the mindfulness returning, really curious about how has the mind been shaped, what is the relationship to experience in this moment? Sometimes that wandering, whatever has been shaped by the wandering, can become an attitude through which we're now seeing experience. So for instance, if the mind has wandered into an argument and there's a little bit of activation and agitation, and we come back and we recognize, okay, I'm aware, yep, there's a little bit of agitation, but I'm just going to be with what is. And without really acknowledging that activation, then that activation can become how we are attending to experience. So the checking in to the quality of the mind, how is the mind once the mind has returned from wandering, really useful. It's that checking into how has the mind been shaped when we've returned from wandering. I mentioned the analogy almost of like, it's like a world is created when the mind goes into a world of thought. It's like a planet, and like we're waking up onto a new planet. So just a curiosity, okay, I'm aware again, what planet am I on? Is this planet resistance? Is this planet confusion? What's the planet that I'm on? So that's a way I've played with checking the attitude, checking the quality of the mind when it's returned from wandering. Now, one of the interesting things about that exploration is that way more often than you might think, when we wake up from a wandering mind, we actually wake up on planet calm. That it's not always when the mind wanders that it wanders into reactivity. Sometimes it wanders into more settledness, more ease, more relaxation. Often I've noticed that happening when I've been actually working too hard in the meditation, making too much effort in the meditation. It's kind of like my mind is telling me, let go of that. Forget about that hard work. I'm gonna take a break. I'm gonna rest here. And then when I come back into mindfulness, it's like, oh, yeah, actually, my mind showed me, the mind knew how to relax. The meditation was a little bit of over-efforting. So in the checking into what planet you wake up on, if you're not judging yourself for the mind wandering, this is a key, because if you judge yourself when you come back from wandering, that calm or that whatever was there is going to be lost. So, you know, that's just the, you know, that curiosity, just what's here in this moment when we return from wandering. As my, you know, practice developed, I really saw just how much that calmness is actually present when I return from wandering. And so that helped me to let go of the judgment also. So that's a second time to check the attitude. First when struggling, second when returning from the wandering mind. The third useful time is if it feels like things are going really well. If it feels like there's a lot of clarity, a lot of ease in the meditation. Couple different reasons why this is useful. One, and I have definitely experienced this and seen this, that there can be a very subtle greed in the mind when it's going well, wanting it to continue, thinking you're doing it right, kind of a self-congratulations of like, oh yeah. And so, you know, just to recognize, if it feels like it's going well, just check in. What is the attitude? You know, what is the relationship to experience? At one point with practicing with Sayadaw Utejaniya, I had been in a state of fairly clear, stable mindfulness, a lot of ease, a lot of delight, a lot of simplicity of practice. And the mind, it occurred to the mind to check the attitude. And so it's like, oh, what's here? And there was just a very subtle, so this can reveal some very subtle attitudes and agendas in the mind if it's going well. It was a very subtle trying to make it continue, a little bit of doing to kind of keep it going. When that was seen, that fell away. And the next thing that arose was fear that it wouldn't continue. It's like, oh, okay, there's another attitude of mind. That was seen and fell away. And then there was this kind of sense of delight and joy that, wow, there were these various, the seeing, there was the delight and the joy of the seeing that I had, you know, that there had been these very subtle agendas and subtle greed in that very clear experience, and just a sense of appreciation for the practice that revealed that. So there can be, you know, when things are going well, there can be that, the very subtle kind of greed of trying to make it continue, or fear that it won't continue, you know, some very subtle kind of greed or aversion in there. Or just the idea, another one that would be more delusion, I'm doing it right. You know, that could be there too. I figured it out. This is it. That's one that is useful to see. Oh, I've got it. You know, so that very subtle kind of attitude may not be so obvious. So those can be revealed if you check in. But the other point here is, and don't go looking for those, you know, it's more just like, well, what is the relationship here? You know, maybe what you are noticing, what you notice when it's going well, is you really take in what it feels like to have that quality of mind, to have the quality of ease, of balance, of calm, of curiosity, of patience, of kindness, of love. There's so many flavors of wise attitude. And sometimes when it's going really well in that way, we're just kind of in it. We're not really clearly experiencing, aware of those wholesome qualities. The awareness of those wholesome qualities cultivates them, strengthens them. And so this is another reason why it's useful to When it's going well, when it feels like the experience is smooth, you know, just checking in, what's here? How is the mind in relationship? The seven factors of awakening can be apparent: mindfulness, energy, joy, rapture, concentration, equanimity, happiness. They can all be there. They can all be present. Investigation, that curiosity, that interest, can all of those can be present, and we can feel those qualities of mind. We can be aware of them. Sometimes they get stronger as we become aware of them. So the exploration of attitude not only helps to reveal the hidden patterns of our mind, but helps reveal and helps us to encourage. This is that part of wise effort that is recognizing the wholesome when it arises, and the maintaining and the cultivation of it when it's present. So let's take a 10-minute break again. It's 8:32. My time. So I will again put a timer on, and I'll see if I can make it a little more obvious this time. So again, remember to turn your cameras off, and I'll see you in about 10 minutes. So we'll start again. All right, so there was a question. I'll get to that in just a moment. Question typed into the chat. I'll get to that in just a moment. All right, so a few more reflections about attitude. The basic sense of wise attitude is it's a quality of mind that allows us to be at ease with whatever's happening. And yet it can be framed in some different ways too. One of my, the words that I use most for myself is allowing this, this quality of mind that allows what's here to be here. A sense of it's okay. And yet even that, you know, for myself in a recent retreat, I realized that that it's okay quality can have a subtle just a subtle doing or something there that almost creates a pressure to be okay with it. And what the mind found its way to was, again, it's languaging. And I think language is really powerful for us. The mind began to, and this isn't denoting, this isn't something that I'm trying to do. This is more how the experience is being recognized. And sometimes language is used to recognize experience, not as a doing, but as a how the mind is meeting experience. I talked about that a little bit yesterday afternoon, I think, in terms of concept, that sometimes the mind will name or language experience. And sometimes wisdom is languaged in the mind. So, you know, it can be that the mind will express, this is not a problem, this is okay, you know, and that can express something that's happening. And the language of it's not a problem was just a little bit more relaxed for my mind, for this mind. Just a little. So that's another way to frame wise attitude. So allowing, okayness, not a problem. Sometimes it can have a sense of kindness, kind attention, loving attention. So those are other ways that wise attitude can be understood or framed. Supports for that. The first thing is to just become aware of what the attitude is, as we've been talking about, and then, you know, to kind of notice how it's affecting us. If you find that there's a struggle with meeting that attitude, if seeing that attitude, you know, resistance, for instance, creates a little bit more tension, then we can explore the possibility of dropping in some, just some reminders, like, it's okay. Can this be allowed? You know, just kind of the question, can this be allowed too? Can this resistance be allowed? You know, everything can be allowed. It's just, you know, a kind of an invitation again. It's seeing if wisdom is available to come to the fore. So sometimes those questions can support that. Other kinds of wisdom reflections. I mentioned this yesterday in terms of working with difficulty, we can use wisdom reflections. And so the same holds true in supporting wise attitude. You know, if we're working with a difficulty, essentially these wisdom reflections about impermanent, unreliable, conditioned experience, those reflections point to the truth of experience and support the mind to have some ease. So those wisdom reflections, this will pass. This is impermanent. This is dukkha. This is conditioned. This is nature. Those are all ways to support the mind to move in the direction of wise attitude. So there is a way that this practice uses language at times. It doesn't use language in the way of noting, you know, every single moment, but there is a way that we can use language to support an invitation, like we've used the language to support the invitation to relax and to support the use of questions, you know, what's happening, not as a way to dive in to figure something out, but as an invitation to open to something that might not be so obvious. And then in terms of these wisdom reflections, we can drop in these perspectives of the Dharma that may support the mind. I use these wisdom reflections and questions lightly. You know, it's like, not too heavy of a hand with the seasoning here with these questions and reflections, just occasionally to support the mind. The basic practice is just, are you aware and what's obvious? So the, you know, just as we get more and more stability with the mindfulness, as there's more continuity to the mindfulness, these tools can be supportive, and then they become just, over time, they become just a kind of a natural curiosity. It's like our mind just begins to orient to those kinds of questions and those kinds of wisdom reflections more naturally. So it becomes less of a doing as we get more familiar with this style of practice. That's true with any practice, you know, with any kind of tool. It becomes, when we first pick up a tool, it feels pretty clunky. It feels awkward. It feels like effort. And then as we get familiar with it, kind of like riding a bike, it just becomes much more easeful and natural and just becomes how we can engage with it. So this use of questions and reflections might feel a little clunky at first. So use them sparingly. And if, as I said earlier, if they tend to make you think, try to figure things out, try to, dropping in this like, oh, it's impermanent, starts making you think about things rather than just being with the experience, then back off even more. Just takes use them sparingly to start. So there was a question about attitude in the chat. Let me bring that one up. So this person had two questions. One, how does right effort fit into this practice? And also, how do I know if it's an attitude I'm experiencing or simply a hindrance? So I will respond to the second one first. So how do I know it's an attitude I'm experiencing or simply a hindrance? Well, a hindrance is an attitude. So it, especially if it's not clearly seen. And anytime we experience a hindrance and it's kind of driving the show, a hindrance by its definition is driving the show. It's hindering our capacity to be present. When a hindrance is seen with mindfulness, when we can recognize, oh, what's happening is sense desire. What's happening is ill will, sloth and torpor. Restlessness is happening. Doubt is happening. We can recognize those that I would say the hindrances are certain, a different cut of flavor of attitude. They fit into the flavors of greed, aversion, and delusion. So they are, when they are not clearly seen, they are kind of filters in the back of the mind at shaping how we attend to experience. So we could say that the hindrances are forms of attitude. When the hindrances are clearly seen, and this is the, the teaching in the Buddha's teaching, when the hindrances are clearly seen, they in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha says, notice the presence and absence of the hindrances. When we can notice them, they are not in the way of our practice. They are how the mind begins to understand what's happening. So as the hindrances are clearly seen, it takes them from being hindrances to being just objects of experience. So they're no longer hindering the practice. They are actually they're the soil that is supporting the growth of wisdom because of how they are being seen. So the hindrances are just forms of attitude. But when they are seen as when an attitude is seen, it's no longer in the way of the experience. When a hindering attitude becomes clearly seen, it's just another object. It's just another experience. And every experience can be learned from. And then the question about wise effort. So the effort in this practice, what we actually do, well, there's a couple of pieces, but the basic effort in the practice is the cultivation of recognizing awareness and knowing what we're aware of. So it's the cultivation of mindfulness. And then when we recognize that it's challenging to be mindful of something, we can bring in tools to support us. So that's where what we could think of as the traditional wise efforts may come in, that when there is an unwholesome mind state that's arising, the abandoning of that unwholesome mind state may be bringing in, or the support for abandoning that may be bringing in a tool to help you not just be caught by it, but to support the mind to be with it, or to skillfully redirect the attention. So you know, the wise effort in the way we might normally think of it comes in with when it's challenging to be present, using our tools to support the mind, redirecting the attention when we find that we can't simply be with experience as it's arising because it pulls us into the rabbit hole of it. It's not useful to simply explore just, can I be aware? You know, so it's knowing when we can do that. And what I'll say too is that the basic practice of cultivating mindfulness, that wise attention that we're talking about, inherently contains the four wise efforts. So if we are, for instance, you know, the practice of, so the four wise efforts, just to name them, are the abandoning of unwholesome states when they have arisen. So when something, you know, when an unwholesome state arises, anger, aversion, desire, wanting, greed, when that arises, the letting go or the abandoning of it. So we think of that as often being an active thing. I have to do that. But what the practice of mindfulness does is it creates the conditions for the abandoning of it. When we are mindful of reactive states of mind, it creates the conditions for them to weaken. It creates the conditions for them to let go, for them to abandon themselves, essentially. And so this form of practice really, you know, leans into or explores that angle, that being with unwholesome experiences is not, when we are aware of them, when we have that kind of clarity of mindfulness about them, they're no longer shaping experience, they're being learned from. And that is allowing the conditions for them to be abandoned. So that first wise effort, just mindfulness when we are aware of the unwholesome states, creates the conditions for them to weaken and fall apart and ultimately let go. That practice with the unwholesome states, and you know, you begin to see this with being with the unwholesome states, being with reactivity, being with desire, being with greed. We begin to feel the stress and the suffering of them. You know, we recognize that. We recognize the constriction that's there in the experience. I mentioned the other day, the first time that I really experienced what it internally, what anger was, you know, what is this experience? It's like, oh my gosh, this is so painful. You know, that this experience is so painful. It's like the mind was so focused before, you know, in previous times of being angry, the mind was so focused on how miserable it was going to make the other person for me to be angry that I was missing how miserable I was to be angry. So that experience begins to, you know, it helps the mind to understand, well, this is not so useful for this being to have that experience arising. So what happens as we begin to experience, feel into these unwholesome states with mindfulness is it not only creates the conditions for them to let go, but it creates the conditions for us to remember how painful it is, so that our mind tends not to go there, or it weakens the intention to go there in the future. So this is the second wise effort, the effort to avoid the arising of the unwholesome states that have not arisen, the second wise effort. So when we, it's not so much that we have to push them away, but what I found in that very first practice I did in the first 3 or 4 months of my meditation practice, paying attention to that anger, that first time I noticed it was so shocking. I just committed myself, you know, this was my very first meditation practice, really, to be attentive when anger arose in my daily life. And I committed to myself, I'm going to recognize when this happens. And so I noticed it. And every time I noticed the suffering of it and, you know, kind of just okay, that's there. That's difficult. And I don't know what I do with this, but I guess I just get on with my day. And so I just got on with my day. I just kept going. And I noticed that anger, come up over the course of a couple of months. The anger came up over and over and over again. But what I noticed over the course of the months was that it was no longer as strong. It got weaker. So it weakened over time, partly because I think I was beginning to see it sooner in the process. So it hadn't quite had the chance to amp up as far as it had in the past. But also, I think because the mind understood, it's, and I think maybe the process breaks in sooner because the mind understands that mindfulness helps prevent it from getting as strong. This is that second wise effort. It avoids the intensification. And then at one point, I even got to witness a point where I saw a thought arise in my mind. This is a couple months into my exploration with anger. And I know many of you have heard this story or heard recordings of this story. It was a pivotal moment in my practice life. I was just doing something in my kitchen, cutting an apple, and I saw a thought arise about the person I was angry with. And I saw the intention in the mind to get angry at the person. In that split second, and this was not something I had to do, this was what happened. In that split second of seeing the mind like intending or wanting like to jump on that thought and think more thoughts in order to get angry, the system felt, oh, that way lies suffering. It knew viscerally that was going to be painful and it let it go. So that was a direct experience of seeing essentially the non-arising of anger as a result of the simple mindfulness practice. I didn't have to do it. It just happened. So the wise mindfulness with respect to the unwholesome states naturally supports or embeds those two forms of wise effort. With respect to the wholesome states, it's a similar picture, only it's the reverse, that when we're mindful of a wholesome state, and this is why I'm encouraging the noticing of wise attitude, when we're mindful of a wholesome state, it increases, it's like our system goes, yeah, this is the direction. This is what this system, it's like our system wants to move in that direction. We don't have to even consciously want to move in that direction. So the recognition of those wholesome states tends to increase the likelihood that they'll arise more. So this is kind of what we're doing with the noticing the return of mindfulness. Mindfulness as a wholesome state of mind, when we recognize mindfulness returning, it begins to kind of sensitize the mind to noticing that, the recognition of the wholesomeness of it. And so it begins to be noticed more. And so it cultivates that, the third kind of wise effort, the support of the arising of the wholesome states that have not yet arisen. So the practice of cultivating, when we cultivate the awareness of wholesome states, that itself will tend to plant the seeds for them to arise more in the future. So it is creating the conditions for them to arise. And this is what happens when our minds are lost in thought. What I've seen happen a lot over the course of my years of practice is that as soon as there's suffering, it's like suffering becomes a mindfulness bell. Suffering wakes me up. And so that is the arising of a wholesome state because of the practice that has been cultivated. So the arising of the wholesome begins to happen through this simple practice. And then the maintaining of the wholesome when it has arisen, this is where we actually recognize, recognizing wise attitude when it's here, that practice itself does support its maintenance, it's continuing. So when we notice there's joy here, there's happiness here. Oh, this is mindfulness. When we notice those, it creates a little bit of forward momentum for it to continue. So that's the fourth kind of wise effort, the maintaining of wholesome states that have arisen. So simple practice of mindfulness embeds these four wise efforts. We don't have to pick them up as separate tools, and yet they can be used as separate tools, especially when there's a struggle. You know, when we find it's challenging, when in that struggle, simply checking the attitude is not really supporting us to be present. I've mentioned this a number of times, that if the mind cannot be present, or the attempting to be mindful of an experience just takes you further into it and makes it more and more sticky, that's when it's time to redirect the attention. And so that's using wise effort in a different way.